and on his own. "You aren't weak," I said. I knew no one had ever told him that before, in all the long centuries of his life. "The ability to feel is a strength, not a weakness."
"Not for us," he said. "Never for us."
There was nothing I could say to that. My words of comfort were in vain. I could say nothing to reassure him, not truly, because here, in the forest, his humanity would be the death of him. Perhaps not now, perhaps not for hundreds of years, but in the end, no matter what, he faced murder at the hands of his kind. I steeled myself against the tears stinging my eyes and the hard, painful knots swelling in my throat. It seemed terribly, unimaginably unfair that I was going to leave him here to die alone. The unfairness of it howled within me like a storm, tearing everything apart. He pulled away. I must have lost track of time, because I felt cold without his touch.
"It was arrogant of me to assume that I could protect you from every ill at the hands of my kind."
His voice sounded empty.
"I barely arrived in time to save you."
"It wasn't your fault." He shook his head.
"If something like this happens again tomorrow, whose fault it is won't matter. You might be killed."
And here I was, deciding to stay an extra night, despite the danger. An extra 24 hours was nothing, yet it was everything. I might live more tomorrow than I did all the years of the rest of my life combined. How much was I willing to risk for it? The old me, the one who'd hidden Rook's sketches in the back of her closet, would never have asked that question. But that was the problem with the old me, I was coming to realize. She'd accepted that behaving correctly meant not being happy, because that was the way the world worked. She hadn't asked enough of life or of herself. "Is there a protective charm you can cast on me?" I asked. "Just until we part." His expression shuddered. He spoke carefully.
"There is only one way to safeguard a mortal from fairy magic. No other fair one would be able to enchant you or influence you while it lasted, but it's more than a mere charm. For it to work, you would have to tell me your true name."
Rasp, rasp, rasp went the squirrel, a harsh and grating sound. "You speak of ensorcelment."
"Yes. I understand if you won't allow it, but if you asked it of me, I would use it only to keep you safe. I would never manipulate your thoughts."
"If you did, I'd have no way of knowing." He dipped his head in assent.
"You would have to trust me. I give my word."
If he had been any other fair one, I'd have been combing through his words in search of a trick, the lie of how he planned to hurt me twisted into truth. But God help me, I wasn't. I believed him. I closed my eyes and breathed in and out in the darkness, turning my judgment inward. Keeping my true name a secret was among my most deeply held principles. Trusting a fair one was madness. I was tired of it all. Perhaps it was time to stop keeping secrets and become a little mad. This time, both my heart and my mind screamed the same truth. I opened my eyes to find Rook studying me, gaze shadowed by the hair falling to frame his face. His lips thinned. Reading my expression, he gave the slightest nod.
"We'll think of another way."
"Yes," I said. He inhaled sharply.
"What?"
"I trust you." Fierce conviction flooded me like morning light, searing away every doubt. "I know you. I'll take you at your word. But," I added, "if I begin paying you too many compliments while you have me ensorcelled, I will become suspicious." He didn't seem to have quite grasped my answer. I don't think my weak joke even registered with him. He bent a knee, bringing our faces to the same level.
"Isabel, before you decide for certain, you have to know this would unbind me. I would be able to touch you again when you aren't in danger."
"Good. I don't want you dropping me again." He gave a startled laugh, dangerously close to a sob. He looked at me as though I were life's greatest mystery.
"You mortals are terribly strange," he said in a tight voice.
Coming from you, I'm beginning to suspect that's a compliment. Is there anyone else around? He shook his head. He didn't take his eyes from my face, but I had faith that he didn't need to look to know. Then hold still, I said. There is magic in names. Mine had only been spoken aloud once before in all the world's history. I was the sole living person who knew it. The sound, the shape of it would never leave me, even though by all rights I shouldn't remember it. My mother had whispered it into my ear just after I was born, a tiny infant still red and wrinkled from the womb. This is how it went. I leaned forward. I placed my lips so close to the shell of Rook's ear that when I spoke, in a breath quieter than a whisper, quieter than the folding of a moth's wing, the warm air stirred his hair. And so, I gave him my true name. The next day, the court buzzed with talk of the masquerade, which would begin at dusk. By the time the shadows lengthened, I had not only completed a portrait for nearly all the fair folk in the spring court, but had also heard an exhaustive account of what each one was wearing, who had stolen fashion ideas from whom, and several deeply alarming suggestions of sartorial revenge. The more portraits I finished without incident, the more I relaxed. By the time I'd reached the last fair one in line, I was cautiously prepared to believe my plan had succeeded. More of my subjects had had peculiar reactions to their portraits, freezing to stare at their faces or spending the rest of the afternoon in a state of distraction, but mercifully, neither they nor any of the onlookers seemed to catch on. For once, their utter ignorance of human emotion worked in my favor. I was intrigued to note that just like yesterday, a clear pattern had unfolded. It was always the older fair folk who were the most affected by my craft. Of the ensorcelment, I felt nothing. The absence of my awareness of it was its most disturbing feature. I poked and prodded at the back of my mind as I might a loose tooth, knowing the tooth was loose, yet never detecting a wiggle. At times, I even wondered if Rook had applied it successfully, but he seemed certain, and there had been a change in the glade after I told him my name, a sort of sigh, as though all the trees and ferns and flowers had let out a breath at once. And it was an ensorcelment, after all. If I was able to sense it, it wasn't doing its job. I stifled a groan when I stood, hoping my legs would recover in time for the dancing. My final subject was a tall, grave-looking fair one named Hellebore, who took his portrait with an amused bow. He examined it as he wandered off. Before long, he pressed the back of his sleeve against his mouth, stifling an errant chuckle. He laughed again, then he stumbled, and then he slumped against a tree, giggling helplessly, struggling for breath. His mirth wasn't controlled, inhuman. It verged on hysterical. I'd drawn him laughing. Skin crawling, I knelt to tidy up my workspace, needlessly ordering the teacups and remaining strips of bark. Hellebore had walked far enough away that with luck, no one would notice and make a connection. And then I caught sight of Foxglove. She'd paused in her game of ninepins across the lawn, observing him with narrow suspicion. When his laughter overcame him and he toppled to the ground, clutching his stomach, she turned sharply to stare at me, nostrils flared and shoulders rigid.
"Isabel,"
Gadfly said from his throne. I braced myself and raised my head. He wasn't smiling. His expression was serious, in a mild, pleasant sort of way. This was it, my very last portrait, and everything was over. But he only went on,
"I believe Lark has something to say to you."
A teacup slipped from my unsteady grasp, knocking against its neighbors with a quiet clink. Lark minced over from where she'd been standing next to Gadfly, half hidden by the throne's flowering branches. Her face was impassive as she sank into a deep curtsy in front of me. Then, to my surprise, she burst into tears.
I'm sorry I turned you into a hare, Isabel,
she stuttered out between gasps. Huge, woeful droplets dripped down her cheeks and off her chin. She sniffed noisily. Disquieted, I wondered if she was imitating me, the only example of weeping she'd ever witnessed. It wasn't a flattering impression.
I only wanted someone to play with.
Was Hellebore still laughing? Was Foxglove still watching me? Had anyone else noticed? I couldn't risk looking. With an effort, I forced my attention to remain solely focused on Lark. Despite what she'd done, I really did feel sorry for her. I forgive you, Lark.
Can we still be friends?
She wrung out piteously. Yes, of course we can, I added for appearance's sake. But please don't play any more tricks on me.
Oh, good.
Her messy tears vanished instantly, leaving no trace of wetness or splotchiness on her porcelain doll face. Because, of course, she hadn't specifically said she was sorry because she had almost hurt me, or because she had frightened me. More likely, she was only sorry for turning me into a hare because she'd been caught and punished for it.
Come along, then, she said. The ball's starting soon, and you'll need a costume. I already have one picked out. You'll adore it. It's...
Someone slapped away the hand she'd reached out to me. At first, I thought it was Rook, but instead, Foxglove stood beside us, wearing her frigid, strangled smile. Lark's expression went blank. She swiftly pulled her hand to her chest, but not before I spied a long, thin cut, like the swipe of an animal's razor-sharp claw, fading from the backs of her knuckles.
I think you've spent quite enough time with our dear Isabel. Don't you agree, darling?
Foxglove's smile thawed unconvincingly as she turned it on me.
Lark's so young. She means well, but she isn't the best company for a mortal girl. I, on the other hand, have dealt with humans many times, and I have an extensive wardrobe, filled with hundreds of dresses accumulated over a long, long lifetime.
Her eyes flicked back to Lark, relishing the fruits of her well-aimed blow.
Do come with me instead.
My stomach churned at the thought of being alone with Foxglove. I'd have better chances locked in a room with a starving tiger. But what would she say if I denied her in front of the whole court?
No,
Nettle stepped forward.
Why don't you come with me? I've only just started visiting Whimsy, but everyone's already talking about my enchantments.
So fleetingly and savagely I almost missed it, Foxglove's face contorted into a hideous frown. More fair folk joined in. Soon I stood in the middle of a loud, grasping throng, over a score of immortal women vying for the privilege of lending me a mask and gown, like greedy children arguing over a toy they would sooner tear apart than share. I searched for Rook, but when I caught a glimpse of him between two fair folk's bodies, he had already taken his leave and was halfway across the clearing. Gadfly walked beside him with a fatherly hand on his back, the other brandishing a cravat in the air. We had arranged the ensorcelment for situations just like this one. I was immune to all fairy magic but Rook's, and if anyone attempted to harm me physically, he would sense it. But faced with the claustrophobic press of so many people clawing at me at once, I couldn't quell my rising panic with logic. Why was this only happening now? Lark had laid claim to me without any competition whatsoever on my first day in court. I glanced toward her, only to find her missing. Unlike Rook, she was nowhere to be seen. My breath caught in my throat. I did know the answer. Lark had shown weakness. Like predators, the fair folk had seen her stumble, and they had pounced. Now it was simply a matter of who would take her place. High overhead, between the fair folk bending over me, a branch bounced as something landed in the canopy. I glimpsed a scrap of shiny black before the heads closed in again. Had that been a raven's feathers, or just a flash of the blood-dark garnet studying Foxglove's hair? I couldn't see, I couldn't hear, and I wasn't getting enough air. Their feral animal perfume was suffocating. Light-headed, I tensed my muscles to charge through the mob, to escape the cramped onslaught of smell and noise and unwanted touch, no matter the consequences.
Stop!
A soft, wispy voice spoke. Barely anyone noticed. Its owner stood at the edge of the crowd, hands knotted into fists at her side.
Aster! I gasped. I strained toward her, but couldn't get anywhere with so many fingers grasping at me, so many bodies crowding in close. She noticed and gave me a small nod. Stop! She repeated, turning back. Leave Isabel alone now, everyone. I will be the one to prepare her for the ball. I will be the one to prepare her for the ball! Her voice rang out like a gunshot. All heads turned, and everyone went silent. For a second, only a second, a hot ember of true anger flared in her eyes. I think I was the only one capable of recognizing it. But even though the fair folk couldn't put a name to what they saw, it affected them still. They shrank back, uncertain. Yanking my hands from the two fair folk who gripped them, I managed a clumsy curtsy. Why do you think you should be the one, Aster? I asked, my voice rasped, dry and desperate. I hoped they couldn't sense my fear. Please tell me. She raised her chin. I drank from the green well. None of you can say the same. Tonight, the privilege belongs to me. And she held out a fragile hand. My scrabbling fingers met hers. For some reason, it startled me that there was nothing human about her steely grip. She pulled me free of the throng, toward the stair. The other fair folk sighed wistfully. Oh, dear. Perhaps next time. It would have been such a pleasure. I'm ever so fond of your work. I suppressed a shudder as each one purred their regrets at me while I stumbled past, their breath caressing my cheeks like feather plumes. Aster silently led me up the stair, and while we went, I counted. One raven, watching us silently from the banister. A second peered out of the dogwood throne's flowers. A third flickered across the clearing, as liquid as a shadow, and a fourth and fifth hopped bright-eyed along a branch. None of them showed signs of dispersing. If there was a sixth... But Aster's hand tugged on my wrist, and I couldn't stand there exposed on the stair's landing. Together, we passed into the labyrinth. Whether it was my imagination or otherwise, the unfamiliar bend she chose looked stranger, wilder, its clutter less friendly. I didn't recognize the rocking horse positioned at the corner, its paint peeling and faded with age. I stepped on something and would have turned my ankle if not for Aster's hand steadying me. It was a carved bird figurine, partly enveloped by the floor. We passed a giant church bell grown over with bark, sticking out of the wall at an angle. Farther on, a doll's hand protruded from the leafy ceiling. The collections of craft must have lain here so long untouched that the labyrinth had begun enveloping them, where they would remain for eternity, forgotten. Finally, Aster drew me around another corner and stopped. She peered back the way we had come, with the hushed alertness of someone listening. We were not followed, she murmured to herself. I must thank you, I said, for coming to my... She turned, eyes wild. Do not thank me! Each syllable of her fraught whisper struck me like a slap across the face. I froze, stunned. With a trembling hand, she tucked her hair behind her ear. A smile plucked at the corners of her mouth. She darted another look behind us. Come along, she said, as though nothing had happened, and pulled me into the room waiting beyond. I must prepare you for the masquerade. Thoughts a whirl, foreboding yawning darkly in the pit of my stomach, it took me a moment to process what I had stepped into. I stood in a chamber completely lined with books. Stacked books stretched up the walls like bricks and paved the floor like cobblestones. Gilt titles winked at me from scuffed spines. A musty smell of leather and yellowed paper filled the room. You've collected all of these? I breathed. Have you read them all? Aster hesitated. Her free hand fluttered uselessly, then alit on a book. She slid her fingertips down it, but didn't pull it from the wall. They are craft, she spoke softly. The words, they don't always make sense, but I need them anyway, you see. It's as though there's something I'm looking for. I always think, once I have just one more, it will be enough. Her words dwindled. But it never is, I said. She didn't seem to hear. Follow me, We cannot take too long.
Her hand fell from mine. Glancing repeatedly over my shoulder, I trailed her into the next room. The sun must have tipped behind the trees because gloom had fallen over the labyrinth, leaving its contents vague with shadow. My heart skipped a beat when I mistook the figures lined up beyond the doorway for fair folk standing in rigid expectation, waiting for us. But they were only mannequins arranged in two long rows along either wall, wooden faces devoid of expression. Aster had brought me to her wardrobe. She made a gesture, and an amber fairy light appeared above us, drifting upward toward the ceiling. A standing mirror on the opposite side of the room reflected its illumination, shifting over my uncertain countenance as I looked around.
"We are similar in size," she said. "Most of these should fit you, I think. Do you have a preference for green?"
"No, I don't have much of a preference at all, really. That must be an odd thing for an artist to say, but I'm not in the habit of painting myself." I paused, recalling her portrait session.
"Why don't you choose for me?"
Her shoulders tightened. She thumbed the nearest gown's gauzy train, absently evaluating its texture, then released it without interest.
"You look lovely in green, but it's a spring color. When you drink from the well, I don't think you'll belong in our court."
I slipped along the other row, tracing silk and lace, never taking my gaze from Aster.
"Why do you say that?" I asked. "Oh, I don't know. It's just a silly feeling."
I kept my tone light.
"Can I ask, why did you rescue me down there? I might be mistaken, but these past few minutes I've received the impression that it was for a reason, that perhaps you wanted to tell me something."
She halted, hand paralyzed in midair between two dresses. I was right. A deep, resounding note of dread tolled within me. Something was about to go terribly wrong.
"He knows,"
she said.
"About my craft?"
A quick, dark-eyed glance.
"He knows you have broken the good law."
"No," I thought. Then, yes. Because suddenly, it was quite clear to me that I was in love with Rook, and it had happened as most quiet, perfect, utterly natural things do, without my even noticing. We had stood together in a glade, and I had trusted him enough to tell him my true name. I turned the strange, marvelous thought around in my head. I loved Rook. I loved him. It was the best thing I had ever felt, and it was the worst thing I had ever done. I doomed us both to death. Nothing around me changed, though it seemed there ought to be some tangible proof that everything was about to be over. I didn't collapse to my knees or cry out. I just stood there, breathing as usual, trying to comprehend the scope of what was happening, my thoughts measured and calm. Who was he? Gadfly? I supposed it had to be. He'd probably seen this coming from a mile away. Despite our history, perhaps he'd even enjoyed watching my mortal folly unfold. The thought gave new meaning to the way Lark and Foxglove and Nettle and the others had fought over me, fought over who would dress me up in the last gown I'd ever wear. Quickly, as a striking snake, Aster whirled around and seized my arms. Her bony fingers dug into my flesh like claws. Her eyes glittered.
"So that is why you must leave the masquerade. Make your entrance, but the moment Gadfly turns his back, you must flee to the Green Well and drink before he catches you. You must. I will help you."
I might have only imagined it, but when Aster grabbed me, I thought I felt a twinge of alarm that wasn't my own, a ghostly, faraway sensation shivering across me like ripples spreading outward across the surface of a pond.
"Rook?"
I asked, but received nothing back.
"Isabel,"
Aster was saying.
"No,"
I shook my head.
"No, I cannot. The story Rook and I told the court, it was a lie. I will never drink." "You must. If you could turn back time, if you could do it all over again, would you make the same choice?"
The light left her eyes. Her grip loosened, and she turned away.
"I could show you a way out of the court that no one watches," she said. "But no matter where you go, they will find you."
Emma, the twins, They would have gotten my letter this morning, never knowing I was to die the same night. I shook my head over and over again. I can't ask you to endanger yourself on my behalf for nothing. A cold fog crept around me. There was one thing left I could do, one thing left to try. I will attend the masquerade. I need a moment alone with Rook. Aster said nothing. She thought I was already dead, and perhaps she was right. She moved ahead down the aisle, halting in front of one of the last gowns. This one, she said, and lifted it from its mannequin. I'd never seen a dress like it. Deep red roses were embroidered in lace over its inner layer of nude, faux sheer fabric. The roses clustered over the bodice and scattered downward across the flowing skirt, coming apart as though swept away by a breeze. On the other side, the dress had been left unadorned, creating the illusion of a low-cut back. Once, it might have taken my breath away. Now, there was no beauty in the world, no pleasure that could shake me from the bleak understanding of what awaited me. Mechanically, I shed my clothes onto the floor. I stepped into the gown, almost tripping, my body made clumsy and slow by dread. While I crouched to gather the fabric up around my ankles, I paused long enough to brush my hand against my stocking, reminding myself of the ring's presence. A laughable defense. But it was something. I straightened. Oh, Aster breathed. She took me by the shoulders and guided me to the mirror. When I moved, the lace bodice remained stiff and fitted, but the skirt rippled around me in almost impossible swirls, shapes that reminded me of a famous painting of a maiden drowning in a lake at dusk, sinking into shadow as her dress billowed weightlessly after her. Stepping up to the figure reflected in the glass, I almost didn't recognize myself. I'd been wearing Firth and Maesters since I'd arrived, but never once had I seen what I looked like in a mirror. The gown's rich scarlet accentuated my fair complexion and emphasized my dark eyes to a startling degree. I appeared less frightened than I expected. My eyes just stared and stared and stared like pits swallowing up the light, out of a face as blank as the mannequin that had worn the gown before me. Jewelry, Aster said to herself, and a mask. I know of a mask that will match if I can find it. She drifted away. A latch jingled, followed by the sound of a chest creaking open. While I waited, my hands rose of their own accord to unfasten my hair and rake through the tangled snarl. Indifferently, I watched myself braid it back up into a messy bun, which I held in place until Aster handed me a pin to secure it. I had the vague idea that if I looked composed, if the fair folk did not sense my fear immediately, I might buy us more time. All I needed was a moment with Rook. Aster's pale fingers descended, placing a delicate circlet atop my braids. It was a slender piece, fashioned from gold filigree, studded with tiny leaves. I swept my eyes over my reflection, seeing it anew. Autumn colors. A coronet to match Rook's. She was being kind, I supposed, in the only way she knew how, giving me dignity in my last moments, unlike Foxglove or any of the others, who I now suspected would have tormented me like cats with an injured mouse, smug with foreknowledge, before they conveyed me to the ball. Perhaps until I pressed her, Aster had hoped to spare me from knowing entirely, to allow me a swift and merciful end. As she stood next to me in the mirror, there was a hint of sadness to her distant expression, shivery and far away, a glimmer of moonlight at the bottom of a deep, deep well. At her waist, she held the stick of a half-mask. A rose mask to match the gown, an expressionless, flourishing bouquet with holes at the blossom's hearts for eyes. "You look like a queen among mortals," she said. "You will be the most beautiful person at the ball." I tried summoning a wan smile, but didn't succeed. It was very likely I would never smile again. The most beautiful human? I can hardly hold a candle to Foxglove. No, you surpass us all. Beside me, she looked colorless and frail. You're like a living rose among wax flowers. We may last forever, but you bloom brighter and smell sweeter and draw blood with your thorns. Carefully, I took the mask from her hands. I can see how you were a writer once. Aster looked away. I lifted the mask to my face, concealing my expression. Gazing at myself, I could only think one thing. I knew Aster was thinking the same. I did look like a queen, but my dress was a funeral shroud. She had made me beautiful to go to my death. XVII. When Aster and I returned to Gadfly's stair, the throne room had transformed. Spider silk garlands looped between the branches, their dew sparkling in the moonlight. Night-blooming flowers shivered on every bough, aglow with fairy lights flickering within them like votives. They bathed the clearing in an ethereal glow in which nothing seemed quite real. Not the tables laden with wine, sweets, and fruits, or the musical flocks of songbirds that swooped low before darting back into the canopy. And certainly not the fair folk, who had stepped straight out of a storybook. Moonlight shimmered on the jewels in their hair and set cold fire to the silver embroidery on their coats and dresses. They danced in pairs without music, a strange, silent waltz furling and unfolding across the clearing below, vignettes glimpsed through eye-holes in my mask. And all of them as faceless as I was, birds and flowers, foxes and deer. Their smiles sharper than candlelight striking the curve of crystal glasses. Everyone was dressed in the pale colors of the spring court, aside from me and Rook. I picked him out immediately where he stood at the foot of the stair beside Gadfly. Tonight he looked every inch the autumn prince in a sweeping, wine-colored coat trimmed with thread of gold. His crown winked from his tousled curls, and a raven mask covered the upper half of his face. Reading his easy manner, his smile, and the relaxed set of his shoulders, and noting that his hand didn't stray near his sword, it struck me with grim horror that he did not know. Gadfly had not told him. I was in love with him, and he didn't know. The realization weighted my feet like shackles. Each step required an effort, even with Aster's hand supporting my elbow. No one noticed us until we were halfway down. Then the entire ball stilled. A hush fell over the clearing. Everyone watched, expectant. I halted, trying to muster the courage to continue. Was this how Rook felt? Always on guard, always trying to hide any sign of weakness that could have the fair folk leaping at his throat in seconds? Without the mask, I would be doomed. A rose petal tumbled down the next step to my feet, followed by another. Barely suppressing a flinch, I looked over my shoulder to see where they were coming from. Rose petals were strewn in a path behind me all the way up the steps, scarlet against the white-woven birch, but I saw no one responsible for their presence. "The dress is enchanted," Aster whispered, leaning in. "Petals will appear wherever you step, but they aren't real. Watch." A breeze blew, scattering the petals, which vanished like shadows as they stirred. The sight was captivating, and awful. My path through the masquerade would be marked like a wounded animal leaving bloodstains on snow. An appropriate comparison, all things considered. I forced myself to continue. Finally, well concealed beneath the gown's loose, flowing hem, my boots touched the ground. Gadfly took my hand and kissed it, while, next to him, Rook studiously tried not to react. For the first time, I was grateful for his ignorance. If he'd known, he would have drawn his sword against Gadfly then and there, and it would all have been over before we'd had a chance.
"What a delight it is to have our very first masquerade with a mortal in attendance," Gadfly said. His swan mask's snowy feathers covered almost his entire face, leaving only slivers of his jawline visible, but I heard the smile in his voice. "And what an intriguing dress Aster has chosen for you. Why, you and Rook make quite the matching pair. Of course, it would be a shame if he kept you all to himself this evening. I must insist on having the first dance."
My stomach swooped with vertigo, as though I were still descending and had just missed the stair's final step. I forced a smile over clenched teeth. Gadfly kept talking, but I didn't hear a word, hoping my polite nods would suffice. Rook shifted impatiently. With so many eyes upon us, I despaired of the chance of speaking to him alone. Perhaps there was a way to warn him before Gadfly swept me away. Briefly, I pressed my eyes closed. I conjured up the sensation of cold, claw-like hands wrapped around my throat, squeezing, suffocating the life from my body. Dizziness, terror, death. Throughout it all, I didn't let the smile fall from my face. Hopefully, it only looked to Gadfly as though I'd modestly lowered my eyes at one of his flowery compliments. More likely, it looked as though I had indigestion. When I looked up, I found Rook scrutinizing me. He'd felt it. Framed by the mask's dark feathers, his eyes pierced me with shock and concern. I watched his expression change. First confusion, seeing there was nothing wrong with me, followed by dawning understanding. He ran his hands down the front of his coat, assuring everyone he'd only gotten a peculiar look on his face because he was worried he'd forgotten something. He patted at his sword belt and checked his sword. No, he hadn't forgotten his sword after all. There it was. Beaming, he adjusted the lay of the sheath against his leg. God, he was a terrible actor. What did I expect from someone who couldn't lie? But his meaning was clear. Message received. He would be on his guard.
And that's how I ended up with the entire wagon of turnips, and Mr. Thorsby was forced to return my second-best waistcoat. But enough carrying on,
Gadfly was saying, quite oblivious, or at least pretending to be, as he admired one of his own cufflinks.
I could talk about myself forever, couldn't I? Let's take a turn. The night isn't getting any younger after all, and it appears everyone is waiting on us.
As though I were extending my neck to the guillotine, I held out my hand. I had no other choice. He gallantly took my arm and escorted me to the center of the glade. The other fair folk stood at a respectful distance, having paused the waltz in preparation for their prince's entrance. He placed his free hand on my waist, and at last I had to lower the mask to rest my own on his shoulder. Skillfully, he swept me into the ebb and flow of movement as everyone resumed dancing together. The courtiers flowed around us with inhuman grace, whispers of muslin and silk in passing, but aside from that, silence. "You look very fine this evening, Gadfly," I said without feeling.
"Yes, I know," he replied. "Yet I can't deny it's wonderful to hear my suspicions confirmed."
Within the holes of his swan mask, laugh lines appeared around his eyes, which I had never seen at home in my parlor. Perhaps they hadn't existed before now, an artful deception, like that single strand of hair he'd allowed to escape from his ribbon on the fateful day I'd learned of Rook's commission, or spending years as my patron without ever letting slip to anyone that he was the Spring Prince. His mask was tied with a pale blue ribbon so that he could watch my face while I saw nothing of his.
"I hear you and Aster spoke of the Green Well," he went on.
Mouth dry, stomach in knots, I scrambled for a way to draw things out, to maintain my innocence of my fate, to deny Aster's involvement.
"You needn't lie to me, Isabel. I have a rather unique gift, even among my kind. But you already know that, don't you?"
And that was that. There was no pretending any longer. "Lark told me," I said, the whispery rhythm of the waltz receding as blood roared in my ears.
"Just so. None of this was set in stone, of course. The future never is. It's like a forest, you see, with thousands upon thousands of paths running through it, all branching off in different directions. Some things can change, up until the very end. Yesterday I wasn't certain whether we would do this version, or the version in which you chose not to tell Rook your true name and returned home none the worse for wear, and then due to the fact that I was dancing elsewhere with Nettle instead of here with you, a passing nightingale spoiled my lapel as it relieved itself overhead, which is why I wore my least favorite suit and still ordered the lemon cream specially, just in case."
He gave a rueful sigh.
"Alas, we'll never get to eat the lemon creams now. But at least Swallowtail will have ruined that offensive yellow jacket of his."
A bird trilled sweetly across the clearing. Somewhere among the dancers, a young man gave a shout of consternation.
How long have you known?
My voice throbbed with terror and rage, snarled together in a choking tangle.
How long have you been waiting for this?
He favored me with a look. You can do better than that, the look said.
I haven't been waiting at all. I have traveled with you the entire way, lighting your path, ensuring that you selected the one necessary fork in the road out of hundreds. In retrospect, do you not find it peculiar that I was your first patron, or that Rook came to you to have his portrait done after so many centuries in hiding?
You utter bastard,
we both said together, Gadfly speaking over me in cool counterpoint. He shook his head, disappointed but unsurprised, and said,
That one was a given.
I thought I might be sick.
Clumsily, like someone reaching out in a dark room, a warm rush of assurance bumped against me. It felt unmistakably of Rook. He was testing the bond between us, aware something was wrong and doing his best to comfort me. He didn't know, I thought. He didn't know I'd condemned him to death. Soon I'd have to tell him. I swallowed, pushing his presence away as best I could, and before the sensation vanished, I received one last pang of unhappy surprise from him, as though I'd slammed a door in his face without warning.
You are empty, I said, my throat working. And cruel.
Yes, now that is true. Would you like to know the greatest secret of fairykind?
When I didn't answer, he continued,
We prefer to pretend otherwise, but truly we have never been the immortal ones. We may live long enough to see the world change, but we're never the ones who changed it. When we finally reach the end, we are unloved and alone, and leave nothing behind, not even our name chiseled on a stone slab. And yet, mortals, through their works, their craft, are remembered forever.
He turned us gracefully through the crowd without missing a step.
Oh, you cannot imagine the power your kind holds over us. How very much we envy you. There is more life in your littlest fingernail than in everyone in my court combined.
Was that truly all it was? Was that the reason why fair folk condemned mortal emotion? Because those few of them who felt it only served to remind the rest of what they couldn't have? And thus love, the experience they envied most bitterly, became the deadliest offense of all.
That's why you've done this, I whispered. Jealousy?
I am wounded by your low opinion of me, Isabel,
Gadfly replied, not sounding wounded at all, and in fact sounding as though he cared so little about others' opinions he might not even recognize what they were upon their delivery to him.
No, I am playing a longer game, a little deeper in the forest, farther along the path. And now I won't keep you any longer. Time runs short, and I'm certain you'd rather be dancing with Rook.
He wove us around the other dancers, steering us toward where Rook stood out like a sore thumb, unwillingly requisitioned into a dance with Foxglove. Gadfly maintained an expectant air, but I had nothing left to say to him.
Fear not,
he said to my silence.
This business will be unpleasant while it lasts, but it will be over soon enough.
As his silk glove slipped from my shoulder, he brought his mask close to my ear.
Remember, for all my meddling, your choice is the one that matters in the end.
Hello, Foxglove.
Rook, may I steal this dance?
Rose petals swept around us as we switched partners, disappearing with a ghost of heady fragrance. If I survived this, I thought, I'd never want to smell roses again.
I felt...
Rook began, but I cut him off with a sharp jerk of my head. I meant to wait until Gadfly and Foxglove had moved away from us to speak. Yet I found, as the seconds passed, that I couldn't say the words. I didn't know how to say them. They were too vast and terrible to fit on my tongue. Around and around we swirled. Lights glittered across Rook's hair and the gold thread on his coat. Courtiers flowed past us, whirling but never touching, like flowers spinning on the surface of a lake. A wolf mask turned to stare at me as it passed. I felt countless eyes upon us, waiting for the first sign of the hunt's climax. Two prey,
One alert, the other unsuspecting, about to be flushed from a thicket toward a bloody end.
Isabel, what is it?
I must ask you to do something for me, I said. He replied quickly.
Anything.
I forced myself not to look away. You must use the ensorcelment to change what I feel. Rook almost missed a step.
What are you saying?
Nearby, Foxglove tilted her head back, her silvery laugh splitting the masquerade. I'm saying that I...
No, don't.
He looked at me as though he were marooned, and I were a ship he was watching sail out to sea, farther and farther away. A sickly odor of decay reached my nose.
Rook, I'm sorry, I said. I love you.
Our next turn brought the tables into view. A fair one lifted a pear to her lips, only for the fruit to blacken in her hand, oozing through her fingers, swollen with maggots. She ate it anyway, wearing an expression of sweet delight as juice and pulp dripped down her chin. On all the platters, the fruit had turned rotten. Dark putrefaction spilled over the china, soaked the tablecloths, and dribbled to the ground.
When?
He asked, his lips barely moving. The lower half of his face was mask-like itself, ashen against his dark curls and high collar. A songbird dove down, tearing a butterfly apart in its beak. Whirling in circles, the revelers grew sallow and feverish in the fairy light's multicolored glow. Animal masks snarled. Flower masks boggled at us, inscrutable. They spun dizzily and with delirious abandon, no longer playing at being human, parodying a mortal ball like a nightmare masquerade.
Yesterday, but I didn't know until... I couldn't bear to speak of it. Please, we're almost out of time.
I can't do it,
he said. A raven croaked overhead.
You have to!
He released my waist to pull on the trailing end of the ribbon holding his mask in place. It tumbled to the ground, lost among the dancers.
I gave my word,
he said, stripped bare. We took one step forward, another back, turned. I tasted the words like poisoned wine.
Then it's over.
Isabel,
Rook said. He stopped moving so that we alone stood still.
I have never met anyone more frustrating or brave or beautiful. I love you.
A sob caught in my throat. Standing on my toes, I closed the gap between us and kissed him. I kissed him fiercely, bruisingly, as a cacophony of mocking wails and scandalized shrieks rose from the fair folk looking on. This was what they had been waiting for. A whisper of sound. Suddenly, we stood alone, as though the courtiers had vanished like specters into the night. But no, they were still there. I caught the grotesque shapes of masks peering out at us from the bushes, from the trees, from every shadow, their hidden owners crouching in stiff anticipation like mantises waiting to strike. And we weren't completely alone. A slender, white-haired figure clad in black armor stood at one of the tables. Her back faced us. I hadn't seen her arrive. Perhaps she'd already been standing there for some time. She picked up a spoiled pastry, examined it, and flung it away in disgust. A horn blast echoed through the forest. I felt it in the ground, reverberating up through my bones. Two other blasts answered its call, but those deep bellows did not belong to horns. In the misty darkness between the trees, a pair of towering shapes moved. They were so tall, crowned with branches, that I might have mistaken them for giant oaks had they not shifted, revealing themselves as massive thanes, both at least half again as large as the one Rook slew the day we'd met. Hounds leapt out of the woods as though fleeing from them, pale flames in the night, to boil sinuously around Hemlock's legs, overturning the table as they vied for her affection, utterly ignored. Steam rose from their lolling scarlet tongues. The horn sounded again. Only then did she turn. With the movement, it was as though she pulled a dustcloth from the throne room. The air rippled, and the birches grayed and sagged, bark peeling, riddled with beetle holes. The moss underfoot atrophied to an unhealthy yellow-green, and flowers shriveled in the damp heat that rose from the earth, rank with the stench of decomposing vegetation. The summer court's corruption had reached the springlands, or it had been here all along.
"I am here to enforce the good law," Hemlock cried in a clear voice.
What she said next made the trees groan and whisper, and all the waiting ravens take flight in a nervous, silent cloud.
"By the order of our sovereign, the Alder King."
Hemlock halted only a few paces away, her open hands held out to the sides as though to show us she didn't have a weapon, or as if she were prepared to embrace us. Given the wicked claws on the ends of her long, knotted fingers, I didn't try to guess which. Rook eyed her up and down, and in one smooth, contemptuous motion, drew his sword. He angled his body in front of me. I seized the chance to bend and work the ring out of my stocking and slipped it on while he spoke.
"How long have you been the Alder King's servant, Hemlock?" he spat. "I was unaware the Winter Court had fallen so low. Bending the knee on ceremony is one thing. Carrying out orders on his behalf is quite another."
Even with Rook between us, Hemlock's unsettling, luminously green gaze fixed on my face.
"Do try to be more polite, Rook," she said. "Have a look around. Myself, Gadfly, even the Winter Prince, none of us do what we like now."
A smile twitched across her features.
"I did tell both of you silly fools to run. I told you I'd be after you."
Rook's sword sang through the air. It moved so swiftly I didn't see it strike or see Hemlock raise her arm to block it. They stood locked together, the blade lodged in her armor, Rook's coat billowing around him as the wind settled. Her smile hardened. She dug her heels in, and her arm shook with the effort of holding him at bay. But Rook and I were outnumbered. We knew it, and so did she. She crooked one finger, beckoning the courtiers forward.
"Make yourselves useful, please, and seize them. Do wipe your faces first."
The fair folk swarmed from the forest. Before I could react, they tore me away from Rook. Dozens of hands grasped my clothes, my arms, my hair, sticky from their feasting on putrid fruit. They jerked me this way and that, as though pretending to dance with me. Leering faces spun around me like a carousel. I lashed out with my ring, and someone gave a blood-curdling scream.
"She has iron on her finger!"
the fair one exclaimed. The voice was familiar. Foxglove.
"Take it from her! Take the whole hand if you must!"
An arm struck me across the back, slamming me to the ground. Gulping air in hoarse gasps, I pulled my arm underneath me and lifted my chin just enough to see that Rook had been overpowered too. Gadfly stood behind him with his elbow wrapped around Rook's throat and his other hand squeezing Rook's wrist, which no longer held a sword. Mask gone, he looked calm and amused as Rook thrashed with bared teeth in his grip. Their height difference was such that Rook was bent backward, unable to find footing, while Hemlock's hounds snapped at his kicking boots. We had scored only two small victories. A chunk of bark armor hung loose from Hemlock's forearm where she stood aside, nursing it. Sap dripped down, sharp with the smell of winter pine. The bark was already growing back over the wound, and Foxglove sat on the ground across from me, holding a hand to her cheek. An angry weal stood out on it where I'd struck her, already melting away to flawless skin behind the furiously trembling cage of her fingers. I knew her command had been serious, and the fair folk wouldn't hesitate to follow it through. I tugged the ring off and flung it away, past the pool of rose petals spreading around me like a bloodstain. The iron wouldn't do me any good now.
"You wicked, nasty creature!"
Foxglove hissed, yanking me to my feet. I hadn't seen her get up. I stifled a cry as she wrenched one of my arms out of its socket. Tingling, lightning-bright sparks of pain shot through my shoulder, numbing me to every other sensation. I tripped forward, pushed from behind, barely managing to stay upright. The circlet hung askew on my head.
No,
Aster's wispy voice said nearby.
Don't hurt her. Don't hurt them more than you have to, please.
Her touch alit on my arm before someone swatted it away. I'll reach down her throat and tear her heart out if I so choose, Foxglove snapped.
What is wrong with you, Aster? You would seek mercy for those who have broken the good law. This human wielded iron against me.
Aster's answer seemed to come from afar this time.
I'm sorry.
And stop looking at her like that, Foxglove added vehemently. I thought she was still addressing Aster until she went on. How disgusting. Have some dignity and die like one of your own kind. I raised my head to find Rook watching me, his agonized affections written plainly on his face. Some fair folk stared in revolted fascination. Others cringed away, unable to bear the sight. But Gadfly looked down at him, and then over at me, with a subtle, almost regretful smile shading the edges of his mouth. I was reminded of his many portraits, 100 versions shifting in the firefly glow.
Foxglove, while I appreciate your enthusiasm, let us not begin tearing hearts out quite yet, he said. Now that our masquerade has been cut so tragically short, I find myself unprepared for the evening's diversions to end.
He sent a quelling look at Hemlock, who had started forward.
Oh, I insist. This is still my court, after all, isn't it? Well then, that's settled. First, we shall take them to the Green Well, and we will give Isabel one last chance to save the prince's life and undo all the harm she has inflicted.
The clamor that followed drowned out my scream. I slumped in Foxglove's grasp, stars bursting across my vision.
Now everyone, Gadfly said, it's only fair, and I promise it will be a memorable spectacle.
As Rook twisted against him, shouting incoherently with fury, he gave a cheerful wink. The fairy host drove us forward, across the glade, through thickets and meadows, past the riven stone and the bluebells. The moonlight frosted everything like a dream. My head hung, but from time to time I caught glimpses of the thanes keeping pace with us on either side, colossal shadows striding through the wood, terrible in their immense and silent majesty. Hounds leapt among the fair folk like nobles' dogs in a hunting party. And of course, Rook and I were the game. Perhaps it was fitting that the place where Rook had confessed his love to me would be the place where we died. When we reached the Green Well, it was just as I remembered it, even in the dark. The squat circle of mossy stones filled me with the same lurching horror as before, but Foxglove propelled me inexorably forward when my body stiffened and my steps shortened into halting, balking scuffles. She didn't stop until the tips of my boots stubbed against the rocks. She tore the circlet from me while I writhed in her grip and thrust my shoulders forward over the edge. Freed from its braids, my hair fell loose over the well's shadows. Gadfly brought Rook up short across from me on the other side. It was grimly satisfying to see that Rook had clipped his nose at some point on the short journey over. Blood smeared his mouth, and ferns and flowers sprouted around him where some of it had dripped to the ground.
Isabel,
Rook began. Hemlock stalked into view, kicking aside the overgrowth as it spread. She drove an elbow into Rook's gut, and he doubled over, silenced. A few fair folk jeered. That was when I knew our death would be many things, but it wouldn't be swift. Swallowtail came forward with a winning smile. He stole Rook's crown, placed it on his own head, and strutted around pretending to swing a shuttlecock racket as everyone laughed. Emboldened, another fair one approached, seized the lapel of Rook's coat, and ripped the garment half off him. The raven pin went spinning into the flowers. Rook staggered. Then he lunged at the offender, only to go sprawling when Gadfly lifted a foot and neatly swiped his legs out from under him. A sob caught in my throat. Rook climbed back to his feet, his clothes torn and his chest heaving. I never could have imagined him so humiliated.
Do what you will with me, he said. But don't make her watch. Let her go.
Gadfly sighed. With a fatherly hand, he brushed twigs and leaves from Rook's hair. Rook didn't react. His head was lowered, hiding his face. I ached with the knowledge that if anything like trust existed between fair folk, he had felt it toward Gadfly.
"It takes two to violate this particular tenet of the good law, I'm afraid," Gadfly said. "She is ensorcelled. Ah, but her will remains her own.